And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, December 15th. I want to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can write down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, whatever it takes for you to take action. That's the whole idea behind this. I give you the info, you run with it. Let's start with a report. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project has sent us their 2016 annual work report. And I just want to say before we start that the Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project is vital to the forests and streams and wildlife of northeastern Oregon. Karen writes, with Earthrise Law Center, we stopped the logging of large old-growth fir trees around Walton Lake, our most popular recreation area in the Ochoco National Forest. The magnificent old-growth fir forest around Walton Lake will continue to provide important wildlife habitat. Campers, anglers, boaters, birdwatchers, hikers, cross-country skiers, and hunters can return to Walton Lake and still experience the ecological interactions and scenic pleasures of a beautiful lake in an old-growth forest setting. The Forest Service withdrew its plans to log in the Walton Lake area shortly after a federal district court judge granted a preliminary injunction to temporarily halt the logging slated to start in October. In granting the injunction, the court found that they were likely to prevail on at least one of our claims, although the Forest Service repeatedly told the public and the press that this project would only thin the beautiful old-growth forest that surrounds Walton Lake. The Forest Service actually planned to remove virtually all grand fir and Douglas fir, including enormous old-growth trees, from a long stretch of forest visible from Walton Lake. The Forest Service attempted to use a categorical exclusion process, which severely limits opportunities for public involvement. Much of the logging authorized by this timber sale would also have violated mandatory restrictions called East Side Screens, which prohibit the Forest Service from logging trees over 21 inches in diameter. The Forest Service attempted to misuse the narrow exception in the East Side Screens meant to address the removal of roadside or campground hazard trees, damaged, disease, or dead trees next to roads or in campgrounds that do pose a legitimate threat to human health and safety. Yet the Forest Service has the ongoing ability to fell legitimate roadside and campground hazard trees. The cancellation of this timber sale does nothing to change that. We are very grateful to the tremendous amount of legal work done on behalf of the forest by the lawyers and law students of Earthrise Law Center over the years, including yet another victory from our work together. Working with allies through the objection negotiation process, we managed to get more than 3,856 acres of commercial logging canceled from four timber sales and additional large tree logging dropped, 2,764 acres dropped from the collar sale in the Umatilla National Forest, and 996 acres dropped from the east face sale in the Wallawa-Whitman National Forest with the help of the Hells Canyon Preservation Council staff members. We also got an unspecified acreage of commercial logging either dropped or changed to non-commercial size fuel reduction from the Ursus sale on the Deschutes National Forest with support from Oregon Wild, and 96 acres dropped from the Thomas Creek sale on the Umatilla National Forest. More specifically, the collar sale, we and the Hells Canyon Preservation Council got 2,000 acres dropped through our opposition to forest plan amendments, which would have allowed the logging of trees over 21 inches and a reduction in thermal and hiding cover below forest plan standards for elk and deer. We thus preserved already scarce large tree structure for wildlife, fish, carbon sequestration, and recreation, and higher quality elk and deer habitat continually threatened with timber sale-related cover reductions over the Blue Mountains and Central Oregon forests. 32 volunteers came out to help us in field surveys of thousands of acres of timber sales in 2016, including 19 new volunteers. Karen says, great thanks to all our 2016 volunteers. And I would urge you to get in touch with the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project and have yourself a real fun summer walking around the woods of eastern and northern Oregon. To get in touch with them, go to the webpage www.bluemountainsbiodiversityproject.org. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. With very little activity along Yellowstone's boundaries, it's feeling like the calm before the storm. Buffalo Field Campaign is running full patrols in both Gardner and West Yellowstone, and wild buffalo are currently staying safe. In the Gardner Basin on the north side of Yellowstone, a few groups of buffalo have been appearing and disappearing, not yet ready to commit to accessing lower elevation habitat. In the Hebgen Basin along the western boundary of Yellowstone, we have been keeping a close eye on a few bulls, but they are within park boundaries and off-limits to hunters. However, that hasn't stopped a few groups of hunters from zipping up and down the park boundary, scoping into the park, looking for buffalo, and hoping they will show themselves. Some hunters have gone so far as to enter the park, donning hunter orange with rifles strapped over their shoulders. As we currently have no game warden here on the western boundary, we are keeping a close eye on things, watchful for illegal hunting in the national park. Buffalo Field Campaign will attend a media tour of Yellowstone's Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap, documenting and asking questions. The trap is currently empty except for 40 young buffalo who have been imprisoned there since late February. These lonely orphan buffalo will never be wild and free again, having been doomed to either a life of domestication, being turned into livestock, or sentenced to slaughter. They are not alone. Yellowstone and other interagency bison management plan decision makers are planning a massive slaughter this winter, stating they need to kill between 900 and 1,300 buffalo. The need they are satisfying is that of Montana's livestock interests, who will do nothing to prevent wild migratory buffalo from reestablishing themselves throughout their native homelands. They will be met by opposition every step of the way, as Buffalo Field Campaign will stop at nothing to ensure wild buffalo restore themselves on the lands that are their birthright. Do you really mean that, Mike? You can help wild buffalo right now. Please take a moment to make two very important phone calls. Call Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wenk. His number, 307-344-2002. Once again, 307-344-2002. And demand that he stop bending over backwards to appease cattle industry interests at the expense of the buffalo he should be protecting. You can also call Montana Governor Steve Bullock at 406-444-3111. That's 406-444-3111. And urge him to help repeal or amend MCA 81-2-120, the law that gives authority over wild buffalo in Montana to the Montana Department of Livestock, and urge him to support a new plan that respects wild buffalo like wild elk are respected in Montana. Tell them both to stop sacrificing our treasured national mammal on the altar of cattle industry. And when you call, expect that each of them will place the blame on the other, but know that they are both directly responsible for this war against the country's last wild buffalo. If you want more information, especially how to get involved with the Buffalo Field Campaign, go to their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. They've got plenty of information there. Check out their volunteering pages. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And the Central Everglades Plan is headed to President Obama, and this story by Kate Stein of WUSF, and that's University of Southern Florida. A bill that's a major step toward restoring the Everglades National Water Flow is on its way to President Obama. Late Friday night, the Senate approved a nearly $2 billion plan called the Central Everglades Planning Project, more commonly known as the Central Everglades Plan. The plan was initially approved by Congress in September, but language discrepancies between the House and Senate versions had to be ironed out before it could go to the President. Right now, if you think of the Everglades, you have three or four compartments, and some of the compartments have too much water, and some of the compartments don't have enough, said Eric Eichenberg, who is CEO of the Everglades Foundation. Too much water leads to flooding. Too little water results in fires and plant die-offs. The Central Everglades Plan is going to remove all of these man-made barriers, these levees and dams, and allow water to flow across the central part of the system, Eichenberg said. Removing man-made obstacles will help water flow south from Lake Okeechobee, so it doesn't have to be released to the east and the west. These east-west releases were the main cause of the smelly, guacamole-like algae that polluted waterways along Florida's coast this summer. Eichenberg says a reservoir plan proposed by incoming Florida House President Joe Negron would help reduce pollution in the water before that water gets sent south. Negron's plan is expected to be taken up by Florida legislators when the legislature goes into session in March. And up in Oregon, the Jordan Cove LNG terminal, that's liquid natural gas, and Pacific Connector Pipeline have been denied in this story from the Western Environmental Law Center. Late Friday, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission denied a request from Canadian oil and gas companies for the rehearing of a case surrounding the proposed Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas terminal and Pacific Connector Pipeline, finalizing the Commission's rejection of the project in March. Landowners, citizens, and organizations are now calling on the state of Oregon to cease work on any outstanding permits related to the terminal and pipeline. The FERC refused to allow Jordan Cove to submit new evidence and reaffirms that the record as it existed in March failed to demonstrate public benefit. A coalition of landowners, conservationists, climate activists, water advocates, businesses, and concerned citizens have opposed this project for more than a decade. In denying the project, the FERC determined that the proponents failed to prove the public benefits outweighed the adverse effects on landowners. Approximately 90% of the landowners along the proposed 234-mile pipeline route refused to sign agreements with the project proponents and had their land threatened with eminent domain. Here are some quotes from landowners, citizens, and organizations. "Today we celebrate the denial of a proposal that would have polluted our waterways, harmed our salmon, exacerbated our climate challenges, and trampled on the rights of Oregonians. May this decision start a trend for our government to deny fossil fuel projects so we can fully focus on developing renewable energy resources," said Leslie Adams of the Waterkeeper Alliance. "Everyone can breathe a huge sigh of relief. Oregon landowners in the path of the pipeline won't have their private property violated. Oregon rivers and streams won't be trenched for the pipeline. Navigation in Coos Bay won't be clogged by LNG mega tankers and their large safety exclusion zones. Federal forests won't be threatened with landslide fires and habitat loss. Oregon won big today," quoted Susan Jane Brown, staff attorney for the Western Environmental Law Center. "We are relieved to see FERC has finally come to their senses and denied this outrageous project. This is a huge victory for salmon streams from the Rogue River to Coos Bay," quoted Robin Jansen of the Rogue River Keeper. CalNG, based in Coos County, has been working to prevent the Jordan Cove Terminal and the Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline for over 10 years. "On Friday, FERC agreed that this project has no public benefit. We credit the amazing work and perseverance of Jody McCaffrey and many others to reach this point to stop this hazardous facility from being sited on the edge of the Cascadia subduction zone," said Katie Einman, president of Citizens Against LNG. "Huge credit goes to the people of Southern Oregon who stood their ground for 10 years to prevail over LNG. From the Oregon LNG proposal to the Columbia River to the Jordan Cove LNG project in Southern Oregon, FERC's denial sends a clear message, you're next," according to Conrad Fisher of the Klamath Riverkeeper. Cascadia Wildlands is overjoyed with the FERC decision to deny the applications for the Jordan Cove Export Terminal and Pacific Connector Pipeline. "Our members, volunteer staff, and allies have shown incredible persistence in making the concerns of Oregonians heard throughout this ordeal. Though there is more to be done, Cascadia Wildlands will join with those who work tirelessly on to bring about this result in celebrating this huge victory," according to Robin Meacher of Cascadia Wildlands. "We deeply appreciate more than a decade of work from thousands of Oregonians and the Oregon families who refuse to be steamrollered by these fossil fuel giants. Together, our steadfast opposition protected not just their homes, but also hundreds of rivers and a more stable climate," said Jared Margulis of the Center for Biological Diversity. "And the Sierra Club couldn't be happier to learn the final FERC denial on Jordan Cove. We have been working for years to stop this and other LNG facilities. We hope this is the beginning of the end for Jordan Cove and for proposed LNG export terminals nationwide," quoted Rhett Lawrence of the Oregon Sierra Club. And Sea Shepherd's Cove Guardian leader has been detained at the Osaka Airport in Japan. This news from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Jesse Treverton, the UK-based captain and Cove Guardian leader for Sea Shepherd's fight against the slaughter and capture of dolphins, was denied entry into Japan recently. Treverton was previously documenting and defending the dolphins at Taiji, Japan since September as part of Sea Shepherd's Operation Infinite Patience campaign. She left Japan in late November to attend a previous commitment in the Danish Faroe Islands. Upon her return to Japan, Treverton was stopped at the immigration center at the Osaka Kansai Airport, where she was questioned, searched, and denied entry to the country. She was detained in a holding cell pending an appeal, which in some cases could take up to 10 days. During her time in Taiji this fall, Jesse developed a good relationship with the local police, said Sea Shepherd founder Paul Watson. She did not break any rules and was always polite. Despite her respectful conduct and her rapport with the Taiji police, she was still denied entry. The policy in Japan appears that if any Sea Shepherd person witnesses the atrocities against the dolphins, they will be denied future entry to the country. It is clear to me that Japanese government are denying my entry in an attempt to conceal the truth of the horrific Taiji dolphin massacre from the Japanese people and the world, said Treverton. Denial of entry to all Cove Guardian veterans has become a Japanese immigration policy. It is believed to be politically motivated, since Sea Shepherd Cove Guardians have never broken any Japanese laws nor disrupted any activities of Japanese citizens. Their only weapons are cameras, which document the atrocities that occur in Taiji's infamous cove. It is precisely the cameras that the Japanese government wants to ban from the cove to keep the slaughter of dolphins out of sight, with the hope that it will soon be out of mind. The annual slaughter of dolphins in Japan takes place between September 1st and March 1st every year. During these 6 months, Sea Shepherd maintains a presence in Taiji with its Cove Guardian volunteers. Treverton will be appealing her entry denial to the Japanese courts and will be requesting that the British government solicit a official justification for detaining a British citizen who has not committed a crime and preventing her entry into Japan. UK-based Eleanor Lister has taken over as Cove Guardian leader. Treverton stepped down when she returned to the Faroe Islands to defend her actions in protecting dolphins and pilot whales. It was an important appearance to make because the Faroese court case established the principle that driving dolphins and pilot whales onto the shore is a violation of Danish law pertaining to the cruelty of animals, and the Earth First Update reported that story previously. If you want more information, go to www.seashepherd.org or seashepherd.org.au. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has busted striped bass traffickers in Fresno County. Wildlife officers have arrested two suspects for trafficking striped bass in Fresno County, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife announced. Lipo Herr, 32, and Quay Herr, 35, both of Fresno, were arrested Thursday morning, December 8th, on charges of illegally selling striped bass on the black market. Over the last year, wildlife officers checked the two men on several occasions as they were fishing throughout California's Central Valley. Both men were frequently found to be in violation of various laws, including possession of gross over limits and retention of undersized striped bass. The two men were cited a total of 8 times in the last year, and the egregious nature of their poaching activities led wildlife officers to believe that they may be selling fish on the black market. Wildlife officers analyzed the suspects' citation history and began a focused investigation, collecting an abundance of evidence showing that they had made thousands of dollars through the illegal sale of wild-caught striped bass. The investigation culminated in multiple search warrants served Thursday morning, where wildlife officers located live crappie and bluegill in an aquarium, frozen striped bass, marijuana, and the evidence of marijuana cultivation and sales operations, and methamphetamine and evidence of methamphetamine sales. These were bad people. Striped bass were introduced into California more than a century ago and quickly became a highly prized game fish throughout California's Central Valley. Known for its flaky white meat, striped bass are commonly targeted for consumption. Sport fishing activities related to striped bass generate millions of dollars annually for the California economy. However, commercial take of wild-caught striped bass was outlawed more than 70 years ago. The continuing demand for wild-caught striped bass gives way to an illegal black market which threatens local bass populations and the legal sport fishery. This is another example of the threat that wildlife trafficking places on a species, said David Best, chief of CDFW's Law Enforcement Division. The fish and wildlife of California belong to all citizens of the state and cannot sustain the abusive greed of traffickers. CDFW officers booked both suspects into jail and will seek prosecution for numerous counts of Fish and Wildlife Code violations relating to the unlawful take and illegal sales, various drug charges, and possible child endangerment. If convicted, the suspects could face several $1,000s in fines and penalties, incarceration, forfeiture of their assets and fishing equipment, and the revocation of their fishing privileges for life. Anyone with information about unlawful fishing, hunting, or pollution is encouraged to contact the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Cal Tip Line, a confidential secret witness program that encourages the public to provide wildlife officers with factual information leading to the arrest of poachers and polluters. That number, 888-334-2258. Once again, 888-334-2258 is printed on the back of every hunting and fishing license. Tips can also be text to TIP411, which allows the public to text message an anonymous tip to wildlife officers and lets the officers respond back, creating an anonymous two-way conversation. Anyone with a cell phone can send an anonymous tip to CDFW by texting CALTIP, followed by a space in the message to 847-411. That's TIP411. There's also an app for smartphones that works similarly. For more information about these programs and the new CalTIP app, visit www.wildlife.ca.gov. That's www.wildlife.ca.gov for more information. And a Nicaraguan family has been slaughtered by illegal colonizers while planting crops in this story from Courtney Parker of Intercontinental Cry. In a shocking escalation of the ongoing violent conflict devastating the indigenous binational autonomous nation of Mosquita, a Mayanga family of three was killed in a brutal attack by colonos at the Llano Sucio site of the Alamicamba community in the Awala Prinsu territory on November 27, 2016. The attack sent shockwaves through the already war-torn territories of Mosquitia. The family's names and ages were documented by community members, and the Mosquito community continues to seek international solidarity amidst this tragedy and related ongoing devastation. The Mayanga individuals who lost their lives in this most recent and exceptionally brutal attack have been identified as Bernicia Dixon Peralta, age 30. Family and community members claim that she was between 3 and 5 months pregnant. Feliciano Benlis Flores, aged 37, and their 11-year-old son, Feliciano Benlis Dixon. Reports from the community indicate the family was on the receiving end of threats from invading colonos, heavily armed mestizo settlers encroaching on Mosquito territory, acting as agents of a large-scale land grab. They also say these threats were fully realized last weekend while the family was attempting to plant seeds on their traditional land. Elkin James Molina, mayor of Alamicamba, which is located in the principality of Principalca, has demanded a thorough investigation of the massacre. In a statement to one of the few independent news outlets in Nicaragua, La Prensa, he charged, "As mayor, I asked the police and the army to follow up on this case. You have to get to the bottom of why it occurred." In the article published by La Prensa, unverified claims surfaced suggesting the deceased family's land had been illegally sold to the violent encroaching settlers by a mysterious third party. Nancy Elizabeth Henriquez, deputy of the Atama Indigenous Political Party, the only real political opposition to the Sandinista state in the region at this time, has dismissed such claims as already having been settled in a court of law, and explicitly categorized this recent massacre as a revenge killing. In her statement to La Prensa, she relayed, "The owners sued and won the right to the land that is theirs, and the colonos killed the entire family for revenge." She cited ongoing ethnic clashes as one potential reason the Nicaraguan National Police continue to allow such atrocities to take place with impunity. Muscatia, a lesser-known conflict zone where the violent and heavily armed mestizo settlers from the Pacific Coast and interior Nicaragua continue to invade traditional and legal Mosquito land, has been experiencing escalations in terrorism and violence since June of 2015, according to an official statement issued by the Mosquito Council of Elders in August of this year. In a statement published by the Ecologist in October, the elders explain, "Since ancient times, we've cared for our forests, because apart from being our only means of sustenance, we understand that any alteration to them attracts risks, alters our form of life, puts existence itself at risk, causes drastic changes to the climate, alters the ecosystem, and breaks our links with our ancestors. For little more than 5 years, we have experienced the largest internal colonization of our history. The presence of colonos has drastically altered our form of life. In such a short time, the invasion has destroyed tens of thousands of hectares of our forests, which has led to the drying up of our rivers, causing the animals to migrate and the climate to alter, and we have to emigrate too. Our large forests are now deserts occupied for the livestock, and we can do nothing to curb the advance of the settlers as they have the support of the government of Nicaragua, and we are alone." For more information and news, go to www.intercontinentalcry.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. for a rebroadcast of this program on Free Radio. If you're in North Adams area of Massachusetts, tune in to WNMB 107.1 FM on Fridays at 5:30. KRFP 90.3 is in Moscow, Idaho, where you can hear the Earth First Update at Wednesdays at 3 p.m. In Dade City, Florida, tune in to WLSL 92.7 Sundays at noon. Or you can try to go on the internet to Grateful Dread Public Radio. That's gdprnashville.org. Once again, that web address, gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m. Or you can get them at tunein.com and spotify.com. You could try tuning in to Berkeley Liberation Radio in Berkeley, California, 104.1 FM. Sometimes they're on the air, and sometimes they broadcast the Earth First Update. Or you could go to radio4all.net, that's radio the number 4all.net, where you can listen online, or you can download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and air. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.